Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me this time is co-host Ethan Warren.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, Ethan. Could you tell everyone out there where they might have heard you or what you're doing with yourself these days?
Sure. I am primarily a filmmaker and a playwright these days, and so my debut indie feature, which I wrote and directed, did a festival tour this summer, where I got to travel all over the U.S., and that film is called West of Her, which you can check out at westofherfilm.com if you're so inclined, and we're working on a distribution deal right now that should have it out in the world next spring, is the hope. And then I also have a two-act play called Why Are You Nowhere that is going to have a production in Southeastern Louisiana University in February.
Ethan came to me with the suggestion for this this episode, which is Anton Chekhov's seminal masterwork, The Seagull. Now, The Seagull is well known to anyone who has taken an acting class. I think that probably half of the young actors in America have either done Nina or they've done a Constantine monologue. And could you tell us a little bit about what drew you to this play and why?
Sure. Well, for one thing, when I was auditioning people for a staged reading of my play that I did this summer, I saw a whole lot of people submitting Nina's monologues. So you weren't kidding. Yeah, so I first came to Chekhov, I came to in high school because we read Uncle Vanya when I was a senior. But The Seagull I came to when I was in college. I took a course on Shakespeare and theater, and we traveled to London for 3 weeks. And we had tickets to go see a production at the Royal Shakespeare Company that had Ian McKellen in the Soren role. And I was just so not into it. We were staying in London, so we were up late at night being college students. Then we were up really early that day, took the train out, and we saw this production at the RSC in the late morning, knowing that we had to see another play in the afternoon and take the train home. And so the production started, and it was so sort of stodgy and traditional and, like, you know, just right down the middle, that I hate to say it. And it was Ian McKellen's day off, and I was like, I'm just going to take a nap right now. And so I just thought, like, I don't like this play. This is just everything that is boring about, you know, classical playwriting. And then in 2008, I was living in Cambridge, Mass, and I saw a production of The Seagull at the American Repertory Theater, which is a really, really cool theater that I'm sure you're familiar with, John.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And this production just, like, I don't even know why I grabbed tickets. I must have read a good review, but it just, like, blew my mind wide open. It was just everything that the other production wasn't. It was really weird and kind of took place in this, like, post-apocalyptic train station kind of thing, and just treated it with all of the irreverence that the production I had slept through, you know, had lacked. And I know that after intermission, the cast was on stage dancing to, I want to say, Sweet Child of Mine, and something about that production, I think, really unlocked what makes the play work for me. And that's definitely something I want to talk about. Because I think this is a play that the more reverence you come at it with, I think the easier it is to be disinterested, obviously, in my personal experience. And then, yeah, just since then, I have just really dug really deep into it for the last few years. Particularly, I did some work adapting the script into a modernized version myself as a playwriting exercise. So I feel like I sort of know this one inside and out at this point.
I think it's really interesting what you say about the amount of reverence that productions bring to this, because this is a play that's very famous for the fact that when Chekhov wrote it, he said he intended it to be a comedy. And when it was produced in its, not its first production, but its most famous production, the Stanislavski production, Stanislavski saw it more as a tragedy. And I think that that tension between comedy and tragedy, between whether or not this is a deadly serious play about very serious things, or whether this is in fact a kind of a crazy drawing room comedy about people complaining about their life, I think that, that really comes up in on the stage. If you read it, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of the translator, I think, because Chekhov is a marvelous writer of dialogue, but if you read him in, say, the Constant Garnett translation, you might not feel that. I was in a production of Chekhov's of The Seagull in college. I was Yakov, who is the character who has, I think, two lines in the play. I basically was the guy who carried everyone's luggage on and off stage. And you wouldn't think that such a small role would have any effect at all on the audience, but the audience loved me. I just put on a big beard and I walked in wearing a Cossack tunic and everyone thought I was hilarious. My college production, I think the director played it more for the humor in the script, for which there's a lot of it. What do you think? Do you see this as the mode of this play is primarily humorous or tragic or something else?
Yeah, that is something I think about a lot with this one. And I think one of the reasons that I come back to this play so often is I think the pieces of art that I get the most obsessed with are the ones that I still have questions, that I just feel like, well, maybe if I go back this one more time, like this time I'll get it. And this is one where, yeah, I mean, on page one, it is a comedy in four acts, but it ends with one of the central characters putting a bullet in his head, obviously. So, which would traditionally be what indicates it's a tragedy, but there are parts of it that I find very, very funny. And that's where, again, like I say, coming at it with reverence, I think, does the play a disservice, because there are several characters that I think are very comic, and depending on productions I've seen and film productions I've seen, can come off as misinterpreted, I think. And the ones I always go to are Medvedenko and Masha, mm-hmm. who are both arguably, you know, I would say among the most tragic figures in this play, full of tragic figures, but also are the ones that I find the funniest. I was thinking about this today, like, is Medvedenko possibly the most tragic figure in this play? Cause he is the guy who just is sort of doomed to follow along being abused by his wife, who he is in love with, and she just has no regard for him at all. But he seems kind of okay with it and is throwing off these lines about constantly wondering how much everybody makes and is so obsessed with money. And those seem like comic relief bits to me.
Yeah, Medvedenko doesn't just get it from his wife. He gets it from his in-laws, too. Late in the play, there's a sequence where he wants to go home, which means in the 19th century, either you get a horse or you walk right. for 5, 10, 15 miles, and no one seems particularly concerned about him. In fact, after he leaves without a horse, his father-in-law says he'll probably make it.
Yeah. And that's so funny to me, even if it is in the middle of this very sad play. And I see, yeah, Medvedenko, they all have like three extremely long, you know, difficult to pronounce Russian names. So right. apologies for any now, mispronunciations I'm going to have.
That's okay. We will both get the names wrong. You don't know this, but the last episode I recorded was for Crime and Punishment, and I went over just briefly here what the Russian naming system is. And just so everyone knows, again, you have a given name, you have the patronymic, which is just your father's name. So if you're Ivan Ivanovich, that means you're Ivan, son of Ivan. And then you have a third name, which is your given family name. And by tradition, in a play, when characters are indicated, they're indicated by their family name, unless there's a reason not to. For example, maybe there's two or three people of the same family, and so then they might switch over to the given name. But to confuse things much more, everyone has diminutives. Constantine, one of the two main male protagonists, the younger one, his diminutive is quite often Kostya, but it could be one of a bunch of other ones too. And he's often referred to as Konstantin Gavrilovich, because that's how you would refer to him if you are on intimate terms with him. Yeah, it's a mess, but it makes perfect sense when you see it.
Right. Yeah, and it seems like each one of them has a name that, at least for me, is easiest to latch onto.
So this is a story about a bunch of middle class to upper class Russians, amongst the landed gentry. Others are professionals. So there's they're kind of living a bourgeois life in the country, and it all takes place on the estate of Soren. You mentioned this was the character that Ian McKellen was playing in the production, or he should have been playing, except that you didn't see him then because he was taking a day off.
Because I was sleeping.
Right. So Soren is, in a lot of these Russian novels and plays, people work in the civil service, and I you never quite know exactly what that means. It just seems to be like some sort of a cushy government job you get, and Soren seemed to have had one of these and has retired to the country. And he's having a bunch of friends over to watch a play. Now, Soren is the older brother of Arkadina, Irina Nikolaevna, Nikolavina Arkadina. Normally, she's just called Arkadina, I believe.
Yeah, that's the one I usually go with.
Yeah. And she is this celebrated actress who is in her late in her career now. She was a great talent, a great beauty, and sort of represents the theatrical establishment. She's there again because Soren is her older brother, and she has a son who is Konstantin. And Konstantin wants to put on a play. So we open with a bunch of kind of well-to-do, sort of in many ways disinterested Russians sitting out on a lawn to watch Konstantin's play. And what a play it is.
I hate to say it. When I reread it, I often just sort of skip that part. Because I can't tell even if it's supposed to have a whole lot of connection to what is happening in the rest of the story, or if it's just like insert pretentious insanity here.
You're talking about Konstantin's play here.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, now Konstantin's play isn't so much a play as it is that Nina, who is Konstantin's great love and a young girl who lives nearby, is going to come out and deliver a long speech about sort of symbolist themes. And I think that I think that it's a parody that probably makes more sense in the context that the play was written in. You know,
sure.
I've read a few symbolist plays back in college, and they're the sort of thing that nobody ever produces anymore. There was an attempt, I think, in the late 19th century, early 20th century to find different forms for plays. There were, and people were very interested in this idea of what can you do in a play that isn't just people talking to each other.
Sure.
And usually you end up with a mess, like what Constantine's play is. Now, you mentioned Masha and Medvedenka. Masha is the daughter of the caretaker of Soren's estate, and she is hopelessly in love with Constantine. But Constantine doesn't really care about her. And Medvedenka is a poor school teacher from the local parish who is desperately in love with Masha. As the play opens, it seems very unlikely that love will be requited. It opens with the very famous scene between the two of them, where Medvedenka asks Masha, "Why do you always wear black?" And she says, "I'm in mourning for my life."
I love that line so much.
And I think the way that line is delivered is going to be a huge key to the opening of this play. Either you see that as desperately sad and you're going to kind of wallow in that for the next 2 hours, or you see that as hilarious in a way and a jumping off point for what I like to see this as my director told me, it's about a lot of people who like to complain about their lives. And who are convinced that their lives suck much worse than anyone else's life. And whenever anyone talks about how bad their life sucks, they're going to say, "Yeah, well, listen to my life."
Yeah, yeah. Well, you say it's either sort of tragic or it's funny, and I think threading that needle and braiding it in just the right way is so essential to, yeah, making the character work and by that making the play work.
Obviously, Masha is, in many ways, she's sort of the 19th century equivalent of a goth, in that she is constantly
absolutely
wearing her mourning on her sleeve and telling anyone who listens to her how sad her life is. But she's not the only one. As you mentioned, Medvedenko is constantly talking about money. Soren is at the end of his life complaining about how he never accomplished anything in life. There is a country doctor named Dorn who is there to take care of Soren, and he kind of represents like a very stoic practicality about everything. He's the one who's always telling everyone to shut up about their problems, especially Soren. But he also is beloved by Masha's mother. Everyone is in love with someone in this play, but none of the pairs work themselves out really.
Yeah, and it's just a whole web of unrequited loves. And Dorn is sort of the only one who feels above it all to me and reasonable. And he is, I think, absolutely my sort of, if not my favorite, then the character that I sort of latch onto as, you know, this is the guy who has it all together in the midst of this total mess of, you know, depressive sad sacks.
Right. But on the other hand, his answer to everything is, you just have to kind of stoically bear it, you know. Is there like he when Soren talks about how he is sad that his life is almost over, Dorn says, "Well, it's hardly time to be worried about that now. Your life is almost over."
Yeah, well, but in terms of you know, we just have to bear it, that does sort of end up being Nina's moral at the end of the play, though I know that we're going to talk more about her speech later.
Yeah,
and that also sort of connects with the ending of Uncle Vanya, which again is like, what are we going to do? Well, get up tomorrow and do it all over again, because that's what you got to do until you die. That sort of seems like what the large theme of a lot of Chekhov's plays is.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned Arkadina, Soren's actress sister. Now, Arkadina has brought along the other main male character, Trigorin, who is a very successful novelist, but a novelist of extremely popular kind of middlebrow prose, and Constantine hates him for this. I mean, Constantine hates him, I think, mostly because he's sleeping with his mom, and Constantine has a very strange relationship with his mom. But he also hates
some shades of Hamlet is something people bring up a lot in relation to this.
Well, he quotes Hamlet himself.
Well, yeah.
Both he and Arcadia. That's the kind of gross relationship this mom and son have. Is his mom starts quoting Hamlet and her son quotes it back to him, basically calling her a whore. But Tregoran is there kind of as a bemused, highly successful, you know, it's sort of like if Stephen King were dropped down in the midst of a film festival where there's a bunch of really artsy documentaries showing or something like that. And then suddenly you have this monstrously popular novel writer.
I like Stephen King, though, and I hate Tregoran, so I'm tempted to drop in somebody that I like less, but I don't
want to offend any
listeners.
We'll call him Dan Brown, then. Everyone hates
Dan. That was one of the ones I
Everyone
had,
hates yeah. Dan Brown, so we can call him Dan Brown. In any case, you know, it's interesting you say you dislike him so much. As a young, you know, in college when I was in the production, I saw him as this sort of obvious... I mean, no one's a villain in this play, but he's obviously antagonizing and toying with other people's emotions. As an adult, and you know, reading it now, I feel a little bit more sympathy for him. I feel like he's an honest craftsman who cares a lot about what he does. He just isn't necessarily a writer of good stories.
Yeah, it may be that I'm just sort of in between there, and maybe I'm on my way to coming around on that as a few decades younger than you, but he seems very much like the villain of the piece still to me. And there's the bit where he's talking to Nina and he is starting to sort of spitball a story about the seagull who, you know, is to be attached to Nina, that symbol. And what if there's a seagull and a man comes along and kills the seagull for no other reason than boredom? And that seems like the clear analog to what Tregoran does to Nina. And you know, he chews her up and spits her out and then moves right back in with his old girlfriend. And it still seems so monstrous to me.
Well, I'm not going to defend the way he used Nina, but one of the things that I was interested in reading through this time was Tregoran is like a lot of artists in that he's constantly looking for more fodder in life, in the people around him. And that makes him, I think, detached from the people around him. I think that it makes him treat everyone abstractly. And he's so kind of disconnected from his own emotions. I find that kind of sad too. And I think that what happens with Nina is he has momentarily something stirs in him and he feels as though here's a chance to live life in the moment rather than just observing people and using those people as parts of his stories. Now, of course, that's the cliche of middle age, of the older man who wants a younger woman to save him from himself. But also, to be fair, no one treats Nina very well in this story.
True.
I don't think Constantine is much better than him.
No, and also, you know, I think that's one of the great sort of wonderful things about this play is that everybody is very, very complicated, and particularly Arkadina. You know, sort of moment to moment swings from being, I think, cartoonishly villainous to very sympathetic. And the same with Tregoran. And I think if you look at the big speech that he gives to Nina in towards the end of Act Two, talking about what it means to be a famous writer, you know, you don't want to ascribe too much intent to Chekhov, but you can imagine a lot of the struggles that Tregoran is talking about must be very familiar to a literary celebrity like Chekhov. So... yeah, I can definitely see connecting with him on the level of the personal and career struggle, but just the way he treats other people is tough to reconcile.
The opening act is given up mostly to Constantine's disastrous attempt at this symbolist play, which, you know, we haven't mentioned the plot of the play. That's because there's not really a plot. It's kind of more like the premise. There's a premise that Nina is saying that humanity has died out and nature has taken over the world, and she's talking about nature in a kind of an animistic sort of way, talking about free-floating spirits, and it's hard to say what it means, if it means anything. And I think that it's partly supposed to just be awful, but I think it's also Chekhov having a little bit of, I think, good-natured fun at Symbolist. I don't think Chekhov is ever really cruel to his characters.
No, I don't think so.
That's the weird thing about his plays. People kill themselves in his plays, but you never feel like he's beating up on them. You feel like he kind of likes everyone.
Yeah, I think he's a very non-judgmental playwright. At least I haven't read any of his fiction, I don't think. In terms of the Symbolist play that Constantine puts on, writes, the line that I connected to most when I was first falling in love with this play right out of college is when Constantine says, "We should have new forms of art, or we should have no art at all." I think that's the line.
Right.
And as, you know, a young artist full of piss and vinegar like him, I was like, hell yeah. New forms of art or no art, you know, everything that's out right now is worthless garbage. And I think Chekhov is having a little bit of fun at the idea that, you know, young people, our young artists feel like they have this, you know, compulsion to change the world. And then as you get a little bit older, Chekhov certainly saw that there were things that needed to be changed about theater, from what I understand of his biography, but he didn't think we needed to just tear the whole thing down and play with the scraps. He thought, you know, and this play, if you look at it, is sort of very different than the other plays that were happening around the time, with its rejection of overt action and focus on just conversation.
Trigorin is the one older person in this play who sort of likes Constantine's play. He finds it interesting. He recognizes in himself that he is in something of a rut, and that his writings is never going to be Turgenev, is what they keep holding up as the paragon of literary virtue. But he sees in Constantine that firebrand of youth that he would like to tap into again, maybe for his own selfish reasons. And it's interesting that, of course, the two of them become these huge rivals over the affections of both Nina and Arkadna in a way. But there's a kind of a grudging respect that they develop for each other. Constantine starts the play hating Trigorin, but by the end of the play, when he has a certain amount of literary success himself, and he actually has to get down to the business of writing as a way of life, he talks, you know, I think kind of movingly about how Trigorin is able to write scenes just brilliantly and quickly with such economy of prose, and how Constantine has to work for everything that he gets. So I think there's a kind of an odd way that the two circle each other and have to kind of grudgingly admire each other's abilities.
Right. Well, the other thing about Trigorin, I think, is he's the only one who can afford to respect Constantine or just about anybody else, because everybody else in the play is either a frustrated artist or wishes they could be an artist. You know, Dorn and Sorin are constantly saying, if only I could have created something in my life, then my life would be worth something. And Constantine and Nina are frustrated artists, and Arkadna, you get the sense, is never quite comfortable with her own career and always feels like it's slipping away from her. So Trigorin is the only one who has achieved success and is able to say, all right, well, you know, this isn't quite all that you guys are cracking it up to be.
Arkadna, I think, is a character who really represents the faded glory of the last generation of theater. And it doesn't matter that we're talking about specifically in this play the fated generation of 19th century Russian theater, because every theatrical era has a fated generation. You know, it's, you could go to Broadway today and you'll see productions with, you know, stars who peaked in the 1960s. And when they were coming up, they were, there would be productions of stars who had peaked back in the 1920s or 30s. And they're always kind of there. They connect us to the past, but they also represent a kind of an embarrassment, because styles change so much in acting and in theater that it's kind of awkward to be around people from one generation to another when, you know, it's your mom and your dad are going to bust out the movies they like.
Right. And I think you can connect it too with the struggles of actresses in movies today, where, you know, once you hit a certain age point, you got to really be scrambling to keep yourself occupied and keep yourself getting roles, or else you're just going to slip away into, you know, obscurity while they focus on the next Nina.
Yeah. So Nina becomes, of course, the rival to Arkadina. So amongst these four major characters, we have two young actors and two old actors, and it's easy to see why this play has attracted so many great productions over the years. There's so many people who want to play Nina when they're coming up as actresses, and so many people who want to play Arkadina when they reach their 40s. And I'm sure that you could probably go back through the history of theater and find people who'd played both roles.
Oh, yeah.
Masha, in the second act, is starting to realize that she's never going to win the heart of Constantine. And again, there's also this, there's a strange issue with class in this play that I think it's kind of hard to get as an outsider to the way that the aristocracy is arranged here, because Soren, as a landowner, technically is above everyone else in the peerage here, and Masha is the daughter of the caretaker, so she and Constantine have a kind of a class issue there, but Medvedenko, as just a kind of a school teacher, is at the bottom rung of the ladder for everyone, and that's part of the reason why everyone feels free to dump on him.
He's also one of the few who doesn't seem to have a whole lot of, you know, adoration for art and a whole lot of fawning over artists. He would really like to know how much different artists get paid, primarily.
He really dotes on Masha. But Masha, I think that's the other thing to realize, is that Masha and Nina are both characters who at the start of the play are a bit starstruck. Masha sees Constantine as an artist, and she's really interested in associating herself with art. Nina is attracted to Constantine, but even more so to Arkadina and Trigorin, who are successes, and that's what she would like to be, is a success at art.
Yeah, that's something that I think a lot about in terms of this, is why are any of these people creating art? And for Nina, it would seem to be that she wants the glory. That's what she focuses the most on, which sounds so craven, but doesn't come across when she's speaking as craven. It comes across as very sort of idealistic, even if all she's saying is, wouldn't it be so wonderful if everybody just, you know, fell apart at the mere sight of you?
Yeah, I think that this is a big question throughout the play, is what ultimately is art for, and why would anyone want to do it, and how do you even begin to gauge success? And Chekhov being Chekhov, he's not going to give any definitive answers, but each of the characters in turn gets to talk about what they think. And so you have young Constantine, who believes that art really is there to challenge our pre-existing modes, that's the only thing that is real art. And Arkadina, who sees art as a sort of a continuation of culture and of status and the perpetuation of this this heritage. Chigorin is curiously not self-reflexive. He sometimes states in the play that he's kind of surprised by the fact that that people have goals with art. You know, all he's concerned about is getting his notes down and turning them into a book.
Yeah, well, he has one line that I find really interesting where Nina refers to his success, and the line is something along the lines of, "What do you mean success? I don't even like what I do."
Right.
So, you know, it seems to me that his version of success would be just, you know, being happy with your own work when you finish, which he claims he is never, you know, he just enjoys the writing. And then as soon as he's done, it looks disgusting to him.
Yeah, but that, you know, I know you didn't want me to compare Chigorin to Stephen King, but that's, I think, the thing that makes him most Stephen King-esque to me is Stephen King is a guy who sits down at a typewriter and rain or shine, he will type out 15 pages a day and then he's done and he goes off and does whatever Stephen King does for fun.
Right. I mean, he puts out, what, like a 1,000-page book a year at this point.
Right. But the thing is that's kind of maddening to people, to anyone who has attempted to write at any length. And I know you have a master's in creative writing. I have a master's in creative writing too. Is that if you're the kind of person who is trying to write from theme or trying to write from characters, you can sit there and you can stare at the page and you can worry and worry. And then there are people who are just, they have the constitution to be writers. And that's, they just sit down. It doesn't matter what they feel like. It doesn't matter what they're thinking. They'll just write.
Yeah. I mean, I think you just described this play to a certain extent is every single person, you know, is wrestling with how do you get to be essentially Chigorin? And then if you are him, is it worth it?
By the time we get around to Act Three, Masha has decided she's going to give in and marry Medvinenko. And there is a kind of a, an angry showdown between Arkadna and Constantine.
In between Acts 2 and 3, Constantine has both challenged Chigorin to a duel and then attempted to shoot himself in the head, or succeeded in shooting himself and failed in suicide. And so, as with so much of this play, so much of it is happening in between the acts, and then they sit around and discuss it. And I mentioned, I think, earlier that Arkadna can go from being sympathetic to terrible just moment to moment. And I think the scene where she is talking to Constantine and dressing his wounded head is the scene where I find her the most sympathetic, even if she is being extremely manic in going from loving him to screaming at him. But it's the scene where she seems to be actually a little bit able to recognize her own faults, and they're getting nostalgic together, and you see something human there. And then in the very next moment, basically, Chigorin comes in and says, "Hey, I'd really like to break up with you and go off with Nina." And in just a few lines, she just manipulates him right back by her side. And it's fascinating to see, I think, her humanity just sort of slide out the window as she realizes, okay, here is beat by beat how I'm going to get this guy back around my finger. And it basically works, although then we find out Chigorin is telling Nina to go off and meet him in the city. But I mean, he has this line that he keeps repeating to her, something like, "Let me go," which is this bizarre sort of sense that he is her prisoner and she is the one who is in charge of whether or not this relationship is over.
He appeals to her in a sort of a, "Aren't we above this? Aren't we above society's mores? You know, you could be great and let me go off and have my fling with this this young girl." And his appeal to her is kind of like it sort of reminds me of like back in the 60s, you know, you're saying, "Don't be square, man, you know, let me do my thing."
Right. Well, Nina does say that her parents are afraid that this is bohemia and that it's going to destroy her.
Right. that's a good point to keep in mind with this play, is I think that this is in some ways about the attractions of the artistic life, and whether or not that means, whether or not artists get to live a different life than the rest of us. And kind of, I think that a lot of the people in here would like to believe they get to live a better life than the rest of us, but they end up having the same concerns about money and sort of petty love squabbles and their own depressive natures that everyone else does. It doesn't seem to make.
Yeah, and that's something Nina remarks on, is she says, I would have, in Act Two, she says, like, I would have thought that these famous celebrities would be, you know, again, yeah, 6 feet above the ground, but instead here they are just living like normal people, and that seems so crazy to her. And I think another line, I don't remember if it's in Act One or Act Two, that really feels like a key to me, is Dorn refers to the fact that if we treat celebrities and artists as better than everybody else, that's a form of idealism, which I think is a really lovely idea that I am still in the process of sort of pulling apart.
You mentioned that Act Three ends with Nina is going to run off to Moscow, and they will meet in secret. Arkadna thinks that she's taking Tagorin away from the country, and that will be the end of her, of this little tryst with Nina, but it's only the beginning. And then we have this 2-year jump. It's pretty clever stagecraft, because again, everything here takes place on Soren's estate, so you can do it on one set, but in between an awful lot of things happen. And we come back on Constantine in the meantime has had some success actually as a writer, and he's writing stories under a pseudonym, and he's getting, it's hard to believe that there was ever a time where you could support yourself writing stories for magazines.
Yep.
That's the thing that I find hilarious about this, is he's not necessarily writing novels that are bestsellers. He's writing for magazines.
Well, it does seem that a lot of his needs are being met by his uncle's estate.
Yeah. Well, it works out for you when you've got a rich dying uncle, and right, you've got like Masha hanging on, still hanging on, even though now she's married to Medvedenko. One of the things that's funny about Masha is through the earlier acts, she was saying, "I will, you know, I'll marry Medvedenko, and that will be the end of it." And now in the final act, she's saying, "I'll move away, and that will be the end of it."
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, she keeps pushing those goal lines further down the field.
Yeah, but at least there's an idealism there. I think it's so easy to read a lot of sort of sorrow and despair into this act, because it is insanely bleak in a really, I think, exciting way. But Masha seems to be the only one who's like, you know, well, I'm just going to get out of here and forget all you people. Because I think there's an element by the end, at least for me, that feels like this play almost takes place in purgatory. You know, that Soren's estate is this place where they just lie around complaining about their lives and just sort of decay. You know, even though a lot of them go off to the city and Dorn has had all his adventures, when they're there, there is this very sort of sad, sort of rotting quality to, I think, a lot of what they're doing. And Masha is the only one who at least seems to be striving to get out and build something better for herself.
I think that's a really good point, because this in some ways is an inversion of the sort of the Arcadian ideal. You know, these are people who are largely city dwellers who have gone off to live for a while in the country in this retreat, and that's supposed to be a place of renewal and a place to of refuge for the city and all the city problems, and it turns out to be a crazy place of just stewing in your own juices, and,
right,
and everyone is kind of forced to confront their own neuroses in the country. Maybe if they had been in this, although, you know, to be fair, it seems like bad things have been happening in the city too.
Well, I should also say, I said Masha's the only one who's trying to get out there and do something better. And obviously many of them in their careers, you know, Constantine and Nina have gone off and tried to find some success. But that, I think, sort of is apart from the other massive theme of this play, which is just what does it mean to be in love? And so even as they're, you know, struggling and succeeding, it's really their hearts, I think, that are atrophying, which sounds very cheesy when I say it like that. But Masha's the one who feels like she's going to be able to get out and heal her soul, at least. You know, she says, this is all going to be a memory, and then I'll be a real live human being in a way that Constantine very much is not, and Nina very much is not, in that famous speech.
Now, we haven't spoken yet about the titular seagull, which is a symbol that comes up throughout the play, and especially in this fourth act. I think the very first time anyone mentions a seagull is at the very beginning, when Nina talks about being drawn to Soren's estate, especially to the lake, like a seagull. She says, then in the second act, Constantine comes in and has shot a seagull and throws it down at Nina's feet. And
in a very ambiguous gesture.
And this causes Trigorin to have this, what you mentioned, this line about, oh, I've got an idea for a story about how this girl lives at a lake like a seagull, and then one day someone shoots her.
Yeah, because he's bored.
Now, this is an interesting point, because I have my thoughts about what I think is going on here with this seagull, especially because by the very end of this play, we will get to Nina's famous monologue, which is used by acting 101 classes everywhere, but in which she constantly repeats the refrain, "I am the seagull." But at the very end of the play, right before the final gunshot, they pull out the stuffed seagull from the first act. They said, "Oh, we have this thing," and they hands it to Trigorin, and Trigorin just doesn't know what the hell this is. He says, "I don't understand." And I get the feeling reading this through this time that Chekhov is just really screwing with the audience. He's like you want a symbol? Here's a symbol, and you know, God help you to figuring out what it means.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, it is a pretty obvious one-to-one symbol in terms of the seagull represents Nina, because she keeps saying, "I'm the seagull, I'm the seagull." But I think it is so obvious and one-to-one that it would seem there has to be something else going on. And so, yeah, I think that would seem to be a pretty good read.
One of the things that's funny about the seagull is every time it's brought up, it changes in connotation, it changes in reference, and by the end, as it's pulled out as a literally a dead thing, stuffed and mounted and offered to Trigorin to examine, it's sort of become like a word that's lost all meaning because it's been repeated so many times.
Right. And Nina is getting confused. She keeps saying, "I'm a seagull. No, that's not right. I'm an actress." And yeah, it's become a very tangled symbol, I think, all over the course of the play.
Right. And if this is a play that, if what's revolutionary about this play is the way in which it dispenses with a lot of 19th century melodrama, and particularly the kind of the obvious morals, the obvious themes that pull the audience through, I think the seagull itself is a kind of a funny note of defiance in a way by Chekhov. But that's my take. I base that on nothing other than my suspicion reading it through this time.
Right. Well, the other thing about Trigorin forgetting the seagull is it represents the fact that he has just utterly thrown Nina away. So this moment that clearly is so, so significant to her that it has defined her identity for however the last many years, where Trigorin has completely put that crucial moment out of his mind, and again, just is so, so callous. Yeah, and it's not a particularly sort of beautiful or romantic bird as well, if you're going to pin your symbol on something.
Well, you know, Kihar was a seagull, and we all like Watership Down. So let's talk about this final meeting between Constantine and Nina. Constantine has been, he's back at Soren's estate. His mom and Trigorin have come back, and there's this kind of this, everyone's trying to pretend like everyone's over the events of 2 years before. Everyone's trying to, you know, Trigorin wants to shake Constantine's hand. Constantine puts up a brave face, but he's also, people are asking, well, what happened to Nina? And Constantine is acting as though he doesn't know and doesn't care. But it comes out that Nina had run off with Trigorin, actually had a child that died. She'd had some success as an actress, but has become something of an affected and the early genius that she displayed has just not paid off. And the question is whether or not she's actually going to be able to have a career, or whether her career is over after only, 2 years now.
Right. And I've never been totally sure whether we can trust Constantine's sort of dismissive comments on her abilities. He basically says, you know, she does good histrionics. She can give you a good death. But when it comes to actually conveying feeling, you know, that's not really her forte. And I do get the sense that, you know, people think she's going to be okay, but she's maybe not going to be the glorious life-changing celebrity that she has hoped for.
Right. So Nina shows up towards the end of this act, crawls in the window, and all of Constantine's pretense of being over her just melts away, and there's this very painful reunion.
Why do you say that you kissed the ground on which I walked? You should kill me. I'm so exhausted. If only I could rest. Rest! I am a seagull. That's not right. I'm an actress. You can't understand what it's like to feel you're acting terribly. I am a seagull. No, that's not right. Do you remember? You shot a seagull. A man just came along, saw it, and killed it from having nothing to do. A plot for a short story. That's not right. What was I? I was talking about the stage. Now I'm not so... I am now a real actress. I act with enjoyment, with ecstasy. I get intoxicated on the stage and feel I'm beautiful. And now while I've been staying here, I've walked everywhere. I walk and think and feel how every day my spiritual powers grow. Kostya, I know now, I understand. In what we do, whether we act on the stage or write, the most important thing isn't fame or glory or anything I used to dream about, but the ability to endure. To know how to bear your cross and have faith. I have faith, and my pain is less. And when I think about my vocation, I'm not afraid of life.
You have found your rope. You know where you're going. But I am still carried along in a chaos of dreams and images without knowing why and for whom they exist. I have no faith, and I don't know where my vocation lies.
Shh. I'm going. Goodbye. When I become a great actress, Come and watch me. Do you promise?
It's sort of unclear what exactly she wants from Constantine. I think she's drawn more because she's still in love with Trigorin, and she's shocked that Constantine is still professing love to her after she spurned him and kind of ran off with his rival.
I think there's also a sense that she's chasing Act One, that she keeps returning to think about the performance in the first act, which seems to be one of the only sort of pure artistic expressions that either of them has, and they're both so excited about it before it all starts to go sideways. And so isn't there a line about that? You know, I've been lurking around the stage and crying.
People mentioned that before, that the stage has just been left out there to crumble into ruin, and someone has heard sobbing at the stage. It turns out that that was Nina there crying. She seems to be kind of stuck psychologically in that kind of, she's reenacting her trauma, they would say. But it's interesting that she's being drawn back to that, because in the first act, it seemed just like an aborted, ridiculous play. And now it's built up in her and Constantine's mind into this great momentous event. And that's a, I think, a beautiful reflection on the power of art too. You know, we all attach meanings to art that may or may not be inherent to the work, but they are how that work of art intersected with our own personal history. And I think that, you know, there are several books or movies or television programs that I could point to that are extremely meaningful to me, but I can't really justify them to anyone else because they just happen to be there at the right time.
Yeah, I think it's also something I connect to as a writer. Is this was the moment before it was really a career. This was the moment when they were doing it for the right reasons, and it was the most exciting that it was ever going to be, because it just represented the possibility of what all of the art that they were going to do might become, and it represented the purest version of what they were trying to achieve. And then they actually get a little success and realize, oh God, this is not as fulfilling as it necessarily was when I was just doing it purely because I loved it.
After Nina says her goodbyes, Constantine has this great line where he says, I hope that Mom doesn't see her, because she'd be mad. And yeah. then he walks out of the room to basically kill himself.
Well, and not just that, there's the instruction that for 2 whole minutes he silently tears up his manuscripts.
Oh right, yes.
And I was watching today the 1975 version with Frank Langella as Constantine, and I timed it. They only went for 45 seconds, which I think Chekhov would be very disappointed in.
Yeah. Well, 2 minutes of on stage doing anything is pretty brutal. So
I know. It seems like such an aggressive choice by the playwright to say for 2 minutes you were just going to watch this tedious act. Although I'm sure you could play it for all of the sort of destructive force of totally destroying the room that I imagine many productions do.
You know, I have to say, though, the stage directions in this play are quite a marvel of economy. I think that the best thing about reading these plays is you never get the feeling that Chekhov cared at all about people reading these as works and books. He really designed these to be performed. If you read stage directions from plays in the 20s and 30s, especially in American plays, they often would go on for page after page describing just the most useless things to the I think I've mentioned it before, but in The Time of Your Life by William Saroyan, about 2 pages into the script, there's a description of the way one of the main characters plays pinball and describing what it's supposed to mean symbolically about about industrialism and American individualism.
Well, I'm sure it's very useful for the actor. And I mean, even then, this reminds me a little bit of reading Shakespeare plays where, you know, he is not micromanaging the actors particularly, the way even somebody like, you know, the late great Edward Albee did, I believe, have a whole lot more, sort of stage managing of the actors into the script. Whereas Shakespeare, it's pretty much limited to enter and exit pursued by a bear. And this splits the difference a little bit, but you definitely get the sense there's a lot that's going to be open to interpretation.
After Constantine makes his exit, everyone else here, Soren, Dorn, the Arkadna, and Tagorin are setting up for a game of cards, and there's a shot off stage, and Dorn walks out and nonchalantly comes back in and tells everyone that it was just a bottle that exploded in his medicine chest. And then he pulls aside Tagorin and says, "You better get Arkadna out of here. Constantine has just shot himself," which is one of the most famous lines in all of theater, because it's such a masterful piece of sort of understatement and side direction. You know, we don't get to see the aftermath of what happened here. We don't get to see Constantine shoot himself. We get this weird bit of drawing room dialogue to end this very strange play.
Something that I really prefer in a different interpretation is if you look at the cinematic film version of this, which I am blanking on who directed it. I want to say Sidney Lumet. He cuts the Constantine has shot himself line, and it ends with Arkadna giving her very sort of disturbing description of her dream and how everything went dark before my eyes. And then there's just this long, long silence.
Yeah, no, that's a legitimate way to go too. The
it's a little more striking than just you know that thing that you definitely knew just happened. It just happened.
Well, then I have to say there's a kind of a matter of factness to Chekhov that I admire enormously, because again, this is a play that could very easily get bogged down under the weight of its, I mean, not its pretensions. It's actually
drama.
Like actually bad things are happening to people in this play, and it could be a very, very somber play, or it could be,
yes,
you know, a light play, or it could be anything in between. It could be both things at once. You say you've adapted this into a new version. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I did, yeah. So I just got the interest a few years ago, actually. I've really been playing with this for a while, off and on. I wanted to try modernizing something, a classic piece of work. And there has been a modernization of this that came out as a film a couple of years ago called Days and Nights, that took the play, or it took the story into the 80s, and is just a total train wreck. Has a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes right now, despite having a really, really strong cast. It's got Ben Whishaw as Constantine, which I think is pretty perfect. But what I went into that thinking I would see is somebody's going to prove to me why this doesn't work in the modern day. And I don't think that's true. I think what that movie showed is just a fundamental misunderstanding of what makes the play work. And I could do a whole half hour on that, but I won't. So what I decided to do as my big gambit, was I modernized it, and then I flipped, every gender. So instead, Arkadna is an aging, male movie star, and, Tregorin is a slightly younger female novelist, you know, all the way down the line. And it gave me a new lens through which to look at things that's very interesting, particularly in the modern context. So the most interesting one for me is to turn Nina into 18-year-old guy in, you know, 21st century rural America who is similarly starstruck and similarly, you know, wants to go out and change the world with the beauty of his art, which, you know, it just sort of reinvigorates things for me when this play can get so bogged down in so many reinterpretations of the same material again and again. So I think it's really cool. I haven't gotten a whole lot of traction with it right now, particularly, I think, because from what I understand, new productions of The Seagull are sort of a dime a dozen. Because, you know, this is a play that people keep coming back to. I think largely because artists probably love to think about what it means to be an artist. Yeah. I think there's a reason that this is the one that everybody obsesses over rather than The Cherry Orchard, or even Vanya, which is also a very famous one. But yeah, so I named my piece, Come and Take It, after the line that, Nina inscribes on, I think it's a watch to give, Trigorin, which when she says, if you ever need my life, come and take it, which is a line that I think is very beautiful and very sad.
This has obviously been a play that has been fruitful for you to return to, especially when you compare it to the first time you saw it. You mentioned that this is a play that gets produced again and again. There are some books that you can read over and over again, and plays you can see over and over again, and some that you're kind of one and done. You know, I read this back in college. I've seen a few productions since then, and I have, and I'm reading it now. I get the feeling that it's a play that I definitely can return to. Do you feel like this is it for you? Do you think that
no way. Or do you... yeah, I mean, I'll see any new production I can. There's a movie coming out. I think it's finished shooting. It's got a killer cast. Annette Bening is going to be Arkadna. Corey Stoll is going to be Trigorin. And you know, it's a murderer's row. And the thing that I think I said earlier is it's just I still have questions. You know, I could keep posing questions to you all night and just chew over. Like, I'm still trying to figure out who is the protagonist of this play. I'm still trying to figure out whether any of the characters are sympathetic. I really am curious to figure out for myself whether any of these loves are successful at all. I think Arkadna and Trigorin are actually the most successful couple in the play, which is kind of horrific. I mean, the question of is it a comedy or a tragedy? I think something that I really struck on today is... It ends with a death, which would traditionally label it a tragedy, but by labeling a comedy, it seems what Chekhov is saying is Constantine's not the protagonist. And so a comedy would usually end with, you know, the consummation of a romance. We don't have that here, but it still would seem to say this guy who so much of the play focuses around is not really the point. And, maybe it's Nina who has figured out the lesson of, you just have to endure who is really who we should be looking at, even though she is on stage for relatively less time. And yeah, obviously I could go on and on. I could have questions for days, so I'm going to be coming back to it.
Thanks again to my co-host, Ethan Warren. You can check out his film, West of Her, at westofherfilm.com. Thanks to Shannon Camp and Zach Powers for doing the reading for the play. Their podcast, Stage of Fools, returns with Season 3 any day now. If you'd like to write me, you can do so at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join in on the Facebook page to discuss books, high school, and high school books. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. And remember, everything will be on the final.